Okay. Okay. Study questions for the final exam, philosophy. I didn't know that you can cheat on philosophy, but anyway. So we are going to be talking about statistical learning today. Next class, I probably will spend, depending on how things go, there may be some loose ends I need to tie up on machine learning. So I might spend a few minutes in the beginning of next class completing the discussion on machine learning, and much of the rest of the class, next class, would be you are basically reviewing the semester. And everybody would get a chance. Most likely I reserve the right to call the names who I don't know. I mean, by now, if I don't know you by your name, then it's a mutual failing somehow. Somehow you are not notorious enough in the class. So I would like to hear from you specifically. Okay. So of course, you could come and make sure that you know me today in the office hours so you won't get called. So basically, people who have chosen not to speak much, you know, for the entire semester, are likely to be called on first. That's just the way it is going to be. And mostly this is just to get an idea of, as I said, you'll have about a minute or so, I mean 2 minutes, talking about the topics that you know made most sense to you, any interesting points that you got. Okay, and then that normally the collection of that winds up being a way better review of the semester than I can ever do. I'll just go through. I don't believe in review being this. Okay, for this you don't need to take a course. So I think you are actually, it's more important to figure out what it is that you thought happened rather than what it is that I thought has happened. I thought Russell and Narvik's second edition happened. You may or may not have thought so. So it's more interesting to find out what you thought. So that's the thing, and in general it's fun, so don't stress too much. If you don't know what you like by now, then, you know, it's not that I'm asking you to read the textbook end to end to figure out which specific sentence you liked. You know, by now you probably know what topics you liked, what you found interesting connections to with something else that you do, etc. Okay. That's about next class. Today we're going to talk about statistical learning. Are there any questions before we go forward? When am I going to give a final out? I haven't exactly decided the exact time, but I believe sometime probably on Thursday or something. Yes. Yes. Other questions? Okay. Are there any questions? I'm assuming that all of you basically either showed up or reviewed the lecture from last Wednesday, which was the neural networks and decision trees lecture. Are there any questions on that stuff? Okay. A couple of things, I just wanted to repeat this from the end of last class because we just quickly went through this. One point we made was that perceptrons essentially are finding a linear separation. So if you think of your data points as high-dimensional points in some space, then what a perceptron is trying to find is if there is a hyperplane that separates all the positives from all the negatives, you know, if you are looking for binary classification tasks. Okay? And if in fact you can find such a plane, then perceptron converges, and then you take that specification of that line as the definition of the classification problem. So that in the new, when the new example comes, you basically see if the example winds up being on one side of the plane or the other side of the plane, and based on which side it is, it's either positive or negative. That's how we're trying to find out. We also pointed out last time that there are oftentimes, if you're lucky, there are many lines separating, many hyperplanes separating the positive from negative. Okay? And the question, of course, is do you have any bias towards one of them as against other? Perceptron doesn't. It essentially cares, you know, any single line is fine. So, for example, if it turned out, let's say, if it turned out, let's say, that these are all, you know, let's say negatives and these are all positives, okay, any line, essentially, in the, these are two-dimensional points, so any line separating them is a perceptron. But if you, let's say, look at this line versus this line, it's clear that this is better line because this one, you know, is sort of cutting it too close to the current positives and negatives. So if there is even a little noise in the sample, then the likelihood that you're going to be misclassifying new examples is much higher. Okay? Whereas this one situates itself like sort of as gives itself the margin from the negatives and the positives. Okay, so intuitively it makes a lot of sense that you want the plane that is sort of giving itself the margin, maximum margin from the positives and negatives. Okay? So if you do that, then in essence, you are not just looking for a plane, but you are looking for the best plane, which makes it a more of an optimization problem rather than just finding a feasible hypothesis. Okay? And in particular, it turns out there's a nice theory for this. You can say, you can see that if you consider the convex hull of the positives and the negatives, the convex hull of the positives here and the negatives here, then what you're trying to find really, let's see, is, okay, so it's the same example here. You have a convex hull of positives and negatives. Do people know what convex hull is? A convex hull, essentially, if I give you a bunch of points, x, I, y, I, if I give you a bunch of points, x, I, y, I, how do you compute the set of convex hull points? Yes, I mean, what's the easiest way to do that? Oh. It's basically alpha I times x, I, y, I with all the alphas adding up to 1. That's the convex hull definition. Okay? So, and of course, pictorially what it is essentially you're drawing a nice convex hull. That's what you're drawing. Yes. No, convex hull, it's called just convex hull, okay. So in essence, you're just finding all linear combinations of these points, weighted combinations of these points, where the sum of the weights adds up to 1, okay. And since there are, you know, if there are n points, in essence, what you're saying is if you have n points here, then you're considering alpha 1 to alpha n, such that the sum of that equal to 1. And every combination alpha 1 to alpha n gives you a new point. Not just these n points, but an extra point. Okay? And if you get all those points, then you're in essence filling up the implicit space defined by these points. Convex hull. Okay? So if you consider the convex hull of these points and these points, you can think of the closest points on the convex hull. The two closest points on the convex hull, this is a negative convex hull, this is a positive convex hull. If you consider the two closest points, and if you consider the vector joining them, then it can be shown, I mean, you can think of this max margin plane would be the one that bisects that vector. Okay, notice that the closest points may not be actually present in the original data points at all. Right? These are the convex hull points. Okay? And in doing so, having done this, it turns out that actually you can also see that of the real points that are closest to this line here are these two points. And this is one point here. Okay? These are, in essence, they are also called, I'm sort of giving you a qualitative view of support vector machines, you know, because we don't actually have the mechanisms needed to get you to understand how to do them, which is basically quadratic programming. But I at least want you to understand the qualitative view of what's going on. Yes?
When you say bisect, you mean perpendicular bisector, right? Because there are infinite bisectors of that line.
Oh, yeah, perpendicular bisector, yes. Okay. So these points, by the way, are called, so the actual points on the convex hull that are closest to this bisecting line are called the supporting vectors. Those are somehow holding up the plane that is farthest from the negatives and the positives. Okay? That's why this is called a support vector machine. Why machine? Don't ask me. Okay? This is basically, these support vectors will tell you what this plane is, you know, the maximally far away plane. Now, it turns out that you can compute this plane essentially as an optimization problem. It's going to be a continuous optimization problem. And the specific optimization would look like this. You are essentially saying minimize this distance between a point C from this convex hull and a point D from this convex hull, where C is alpha I xi and D is alpha I xi2, except for a different class. Okay, so these are points from the two convex hulls, and alpha I, of course, are 1. This is exactly what I'm saying here is exactly what I mentioned in words. You know, you're looking for the two points that are closest on the respective convex hulls. Okay, now this is called a quadratic programming problem because the objective is a quadratic expression. It's a square expression. And the constraints are all basically linear. Okay? How many of you have heard of linear programs or integer programs? Okay. So linear programs have linear constraints and linear objective function. Integer programs have linear constraints, integrality constraints, and objective function. Okay, so some of the variables can only be integers. They cannot be any other number. And quadratic programs are linear constraints and quadratic expression being optimized. Okay, it turns out that it is possible to solve these, obviously. And they're not as easy to solve as linear programs, obviously. So if you solve this, then you would get the optimal plane, optimal separating plane. Now, it turns out that if you think in terms of linear programs, and those of you who heard of linear programs and integer programs also probably heard of duals of these programs. So given a program, given a linear program, the dual linear program would basically have the variables and the constraints shifted around. So in the primal, let's say you have some variables and some constraints on those variables, then in the dual there will be as many variables as there are constraints in the primal. Okay. Now, again, it turns out that primal and dual have this property that these are two completely different optimization programs, except they both will be optimum at the same point. They have nothing else in common except at the optimum they are both the same. So if you're trying to optimize a primal program and you don't like its look, you can optimize the dual program and that would still give you the same answer. Okay, so they're not equal in any other places. They're completely different programs, except they both reach their optimum at the same point, and both of them will have the same optimum value. Okay, there's a beautiful theory of duality in programs in mathematical programming, and it turns out that a dual version of this will look more like this. Now, why am I showing you this? If you notice, the dual version essentially has xi and xj points basically taking part as a dot product. Okay? If you remember vectors, if you remember your vector calculus, dot product of two vectors is what? you have x1, x2, x3 is one point, x1 dash, x2 dash, x3 dash is another point. Then dot product is x1 times x1 dash plus x2 times x2 dash plus x3 times x3 dash. Okay? And in fact, you can think of dot product between vectors as giving some measure of similarity of those vectors. Okay? If you remember, again, from your vector calculus, if you have v1 here and v2 here, okay, the value of the dot product can be shown to be if theta is the angle between the vectors, then the value of the dot product is equal to the sizes of the two vectors multiplied by the angle between them. Another way of thinking about it is you are looking at the projection of v1 onto v2 and multiplying that number by the size of v2. Now, if theta is 90, then the projection of v1 over v2 will become 0. So even if they are very big vectors, their dot product becomes 0. Okay? So in a way, dot product is highest if basically the vectors are close to each other. They are essentially in the same orientation. Okay? So you can think of this dual essentially is completely specified in terms of dot products of vectors. Keep that in mind. And then we talked about this separate point at the end of last class. So remember that all of this I did essentially, you could have either solved this or this. If you solved either of them, you would have gotten enough information to get the equation for this maximally separating line. And once you get the maximally separating line, that would be a perceptron too. That is one of the many hyperplanes a perceptron could have found. But I want the best one. And this is the best one according to my max margin. Okay? And you can show that in some sense, intuitively we know that it has some good properties. As I said in this previous case, you could see that this is sort of depending too much on the example. Whereas this is keeping itself like farthest from both positives and negatives, equally farthest. So it's not taking anything for granted. Okay? And actually from a learning theory point of view, you can show that max margin classification has some nice properties. Okay? But what's more interesting is, in trying to compute this max margin classifier, you can think of it in terms of a quadratic program. And the dual of the quadratic program has this nice property that the data points are brought together. Remember, xi, xj, yi, yj are the data points. These are the positive points and the negative points. Okay? They're only brought in together in terms of their dot product, which can be thought of as a similarity metric. Keep that in mind, and a separate point that we mentioned last time, which is kind of nice too, is not everything is linearly separable. Okay? So here is a scenario where I want everything inside the circle is negative, everything outside the circle is positive, or vice versa. That's a nice concept. But clearly, no perceptron in the world can learn it. No linear support vector machine can learn it, because there's no line separating these two. Right? However, there is a very well-known theorem, and in fact, it's not that hard to figure this out. If you actually make, if there are n data points, if you make one dimension for each data point, if you have 10 million data points, now you think of 10 million dimensional space, such that each point is, you know, the value 1 in one of the dimensions. So if I have only 2 points, then I'll just have 2 dimensional space, and then call that, one is called x1 equal to 1, everything else is 0. The other is called y equal to 1, everything else is 0. If you do that way, then clearly there is going to be a plane separating all the positives from negatives. So what that silly point tells you is, if you keep increasing the dimensions, you can always separate positives from negatives using a plane. This is a geometric intuition. But nobody really wants to increase the dimensions such as the number of dimensions is equal to number of points. What's interesting is oftentimes you can actually increase the dimension just a little and be able to separate them linearly. Okay? As long as you know what is the right dimensions to consider. So here in this particular example, if this was your original space, and if you considered a new three-dimensional space where one axis corresponds to x1 square, and another axis corresponds to x2 square, and a third axis corresponds to square root of 2x1, x2. Now, why did I come up with this? Don't ask me. Now, obviously, you know, because this is a circle, so I very carefully put these three dimensions. Okay? Notice that for every point here which has x1, x2 as its coordinate, I can compute three coordinates in this space. I'm increasing, you know, data. I'm taking a point which has just two dimensions, and I'm increasing the number of dimensions. Okay? This should actually make you worry to some extent, because when we were talking about Russell example, I said oftentimes there are way too many features, many of which are irrelevant. And, you know, decision trees will work if in fact somehow very few features wind up being relevant. So most of the time in learning, you want to cut down the number of features because most of them are irrelevant. However, here I'm saying if you increase the features in the right way, sometimes you can separate positives and negatives, which are only non-linearly separable here, become linearly separable here. Okay? So it's very interesting trade-off. On one hand, you want to reduce the number of dimensions because the more dimensions, the harder it is to learn. But on the other hand, if you want to learn using linear separators, you can actually do that by increasing the number of dimensions. Okay? This is known. In fact, this can be explained to people, you know, anybody who knows anything about Cartesian geometry. And they'll understand. In a first-year calculus course, people will understand this point I just made. That because notice that there's a huge there exists here. There exists a new space where any concept is linearly separable. This is like, in essence, Archimedes saying, there exists a large enough lever and a fulcrum such that universe can be lifted. Okay, where the heck are you going to put that fulcrum? Where is it going to get the large lever? Okay, so this was something that people used to look at and feel, yeah, if only we can get there. And what is interesting is the reason support vector machines became very popular of late is, remember I said alpha I, you know, in the previous dual program we had Xi and Xj were taking part in dot product form. Okay. Now notice that one thing I could have done to do normal linear support vector machines in this scenario is to do two phases separately. Phase one, increase the dimensionality. Phase two, compute the max margin classifier in that new dimension. Okay? And keep doing this until, in some sense, you get the right set of dimensions where linear separability happens. And one interesting point, it turns out, is if you were to remove this dot product of Xi and Xj and substitute it with any arbitrary similarity function, which could be not necessarily linear similarity, it could be non-linear similarity function. So for example, I might say that similarity between two vectors u and v is u dot v plus 1 power d. What does this do? It makes close by things become closer, farther things become farther. It's sort of doing a non-linear transformation. Do you understand what I'm saying? The things which are very close, if you, you know, they become closer as you do power d, and the distance becomes even larger if they are too large, you know, farther to begin with. So you're changing the similarity function non-linearly now. Okay? Or I could do a different thing, you know, some other function called radial basis function. In general, whichever you want, in fact, you could, for example, say the right way to judge the similarity between this vector and this vector is to take x1 minus x1 dash square plus x2 minus x2 dash cube plus sine of x3 minus x3 dash. If that's what you want, you could do that as a new similarity function. Okay? And all you would wind up doing is throw in that similarity function number there, corresponding to the vector. Okay? If you wind up doing this, notice that this particular quadratic program, which you don't necessarily understand how to solve, it doesn't change because it is still going to, this is going to be just a number. So the coefficients are changing. So it's still a quadratic program, except you're solving a separate quadratic program now. And it can be shown, there's a beautiful theory which basically shows that when you, under certain conditions, if the similarity function satisfies certain conditions, then when you throw in that similarity function instead of xi, xj, you are in essence doing two steps simultaneously. First step is pushing the data into a possibly infinite dimensional space, then finding a linear separator, which is max margin within that, and then bringing it back to the first dimension. Okay? This is a very powerful idea, and you're getting it more or less free by solving the same quadratic program that you had to solve just to find a linear separator. Okay? And this idea, these are somehow called kernels. Okay, these similarity functions are called kernels. So next time if you ever hear kernels, and you would hear kernels somewhere or other in your life, you know, the way they are so popular these days, a kernel is a similarity function. Okay, that would give you a good intuition. Okay? And if you throw in the right kernel and you solve the quadratic program, you are in essence solving a linear separability in higher dimensional space and finding equivalent nonlinear separator in the lower dimensional space in one fell swoop. Okay? The trick, of course, is to find the right similarity function. And finding the right similarity function is domain-specific knowledge. Okay? What people try to do is, let's try to try a couple of these polynomial ones or some of these ones and then see which one seems to give the best performance. And there's also a cottage industry of sorts which tries to come up with kernel functions for different kinds of data. But that's another way of saying, when do you consider two vectors to be similar? And that depends a lot on where those vectors are coming from and what is their semantics. Okay? So in essence, the reason I'm going through this, even though you can't do a homework problem on this because you don't know enough about quadratic programming, is that intuitions are easy to understand here. You're throwing it into higher dimensions, separating them, and coming back. Okay? Here's an example. Suppose you have all these are positives, and these middle ones are negative. That's a pretty ugly looking nonlinear classification problem, right? And yet, this particular case, they used a polynomial kernel, and they did max margins classification, and they get essentially a classifier which in essence says anything it falls in this region is positive, in this region is positive, in this region is positive, everything else is negative. That's pretty close to how the data is actually looking. Now, all of this is particularly interesting because before this was there, the normal way to do nonlinear classification was to do neural networks with additional number of layers. Instead of perceptrons, which is a single layer neural network, you would do nonlinear, neural networks. Okay? Now, if you do have, so for example, here is an example that a multi-layer neural network can easily solve. Not easily, I mean, it is able to solve. Where, notice that these are positives, everything inside is positive, outside is negative. Highly nonlinear boundary. Okay? And yet, you can train a multi-layer neural network to find that function. This should not be surprising to you, given that we actually mentioned in the first class on neural networks the first class on neural networks I mentioned, that a single layer neural network can learn any linear separation. A multi-layer neural network can learn any continuous function, could be linear, could be nonlinear. A multi-layer with two layers can learn any continuous function. More than two layers can learn any function, period. So it can learn set of nonlinear functions. Okay, so we have the ability, and in fact this can be shown mathematically in a rigorous way. And so it's not surprising that you could find a multi-layer neural network that will fit to the data. So you now have two ways of doing nonlinear classification. Okay, one is multi-layer neural networks, one is multi-layer neural networks, and one is this kernel machines that I just talked to you about. Turns out that multi-layer neural networks take forever to converge. It takes a long time to converge for them, and even when they converge, it's not, they're going to have the same exact kind of a problem. There is no max marginness. So in essence, they're not going to guarantee you. Remember that having gone from this place to this place, you still want this plane to be separated max, to separate positives from negatives the maximal way. Okay? Whereas what, and so that in some sense you draw the circle such that it is like the maximally farthest from the positives and negatives, intuitively. But if you're doing a multilayer neural network, it could find, you know, something like that. And that too separates positives from negatives. But it's first of all a much more complex hypothesis, much more complex curve. So it's more likely to be wrong. Okay? And moreover, the more complex the hypothesis, it needs more examples to even get there. Okay? So this sort of explains why I would not teach you how to, train multilayer neural networks anymore in this class, because nobody is doing them anymore. But I did send you a mail. Jeff Hinton is doing multilayer neural networks because there is a good reason to believe that we do multilayer neural networks in our brain. And so it would be useful to understand. And so there are people who are still working on it, but there is, it turns out you have two tools to do the same thing, and one of them is much simpler. That's part of the reason why we don't do it. And one interesting point to understand about multilayer neural networks is the following. Remember, in perceptrons, what you used to do is, here was your output unit, right? And there was only one unit, really. Okay, these were the inputs itself, and there is output coming out. So these are the WI, these are the weights, and you are changing the weights in terms of, to reduce the error between prediction and observed class. Okay? What happens in multilayer neural networks is you have weights here as well as weights here. You only see error here. You don't know how much of this error is to be attributed to this guy, how much to be attributed to this guy, how much to be attributed to this guy, etc. Based on how much of the error is this guy's problem, his weights have to be changed. For the longest time, multilayer neural networks training didn't go anywhere because people were arguing with each other as to how do you allocate the error to the intermediate layer. This is the credit assignment problem. If there's a bunch of people, after all of them something went wrong, who do you blame for how much of the problem? Okay? And what backpropagation, which is a simple idea, what it does essentially is more or less it's proportionally allocate the error to each of these layers based on the weight that they connect to the output layer. So if this guy is connecting to the output layer with, 10 weight, and this guy is connected to 1 weight, then this guy gets 10 times more of the error than this guy does. Now, there is no real reason to believe that this is the right thing to do, but it's better than nothing. Okay? And back propagation cannot be shown to converge to the optimal neural network of any kind. And in fact, it can get stuck in all sorts of local minima. But when it first came about, that was the only idea, and even now is more or less that's the best idea. And it turns out back propagation takes too long to converge. Okay? Thankfully, we have this other player, kernel machines, which are easier. The funnier thing is, to understand kernel machines deeply, you need to understand quadratic programming, for which you need to understand mathematical programming, which many of you, probably some of you know, some of you don't. So that's why I'm not going into it too much detail. Okay. Read that. Okay. So this one actually shows, for example, that for the Russell domain, decision trees are here, perceptrons are here. If you do multi-layer networks, you can see that they do better than perceptrons. They're slowly inching their way upward in terms of higher and higher accuracy. In a sense, actually, eventually they will converge to full accuracy, but they take longer time. Notice that the learning rate is really slow. The learning rate is with respect to the number of training examples. It takes a lot more training examples for it to figure out what the concept is. Okay. But if you get the right kernel, your kernel-based max margin classifier can look quite fast in those domains. Any questions? Okay. So what I'm going to do now is actually do a little bit of learning-based networks. Okay, so we sort of looked at how to learn logical expressions, because decision trees are logical expressions. Do you understand that? A decision tree is a logical expression. I hope you understand this. If not, then you may be sure. Suppose I have a decision tree like this. That's my decision tree. Okay? So it's asking the question, is P true in the example? If the answer is yes, then the example is positive. I mean, its class is positive. If it's no, then I ask, is Q true? If so, if they yes, then the answer is no. If yes, if Q is not true, then the answer is yes. Okay? This is a Boolean classification. Suppose the class that I am looking for is R. Is R going to be true or not? R being whether Russell will stop at the restaurant, let's say. Okay? I would say that this is essentially saying R, if and only if P, R, not P, and not Q. You see this? So, decision trees are actually learning logic. Okay? And that's basically what we were saying. You know, they can actually express any arbitrary logical form, because in essence, this kind of a form is what's called the DNF form. It's disjunction of conjunctions. And any random logical formula can be put in either CNF or DNF form. And there would be a decision tree that will be equivalent to it. Yes? No, but what I'm saying here is that, all I'm saying is this is my hypothesis. The entire learning is an inductive leap. It's not in the deductive closure of your background knowledge. Okay? But if you believe this is what you're going to use to decide R, then this is your theory. Okay. Yes, I'm adding a new theory. So I started with zero theory. I had nothing. And now I have a new axiom. Basically learning logic now. Okay. So the question then is, so we know how to learn logic. We also know how to learn separator functions like neural networks and max matching classifiers will give you separator functions. One other thing we could like, another type of knowledge representation we read about is probabilistic representation. So the question is, if I tell you this is the Bayes network for this domain, can you pick up all the conditional probability tables? If I don't even tell you, can you actually make up a Bayes network for the domain with the Bayes network topology as well as conditional probabilities? That's what's doing it. Again, learning that we are doing here is connected to the knowledge that we, the representations that we looked at previously. Okay. So we'll look at some of the issues involved in basically thinking of learning from a Bayesian perspective, from a probabilistic perspective. And then from there go to a very simple probabilistic learning idea called naive Bayes classification, which the idea there also works for any complete Bayes network learning, where if somebody tells you the entire topology of the Bayes network and gives you complete examples, then you can set the CPTs from the examples. Okay? And what's surprising really is that, let me jump to the end and then come back. Okay. Suppose I have decided to do, suppose I have decided to do, this is Russell example. Okay. Suppose I have decided to learn Russell example as using a Bayes network. Okay. So furthermore, suppose I have decided that the correct Bayes network topology is the following. Will weight is a node and it causes everything else. So number of patterns, is it raining? What else? Price. Suppose this is my Bayes network. Okay, so I went ahead and decided that there's a theory behind, a probabilistic theory behind how Russell is waiting about at restaurants. The theory is that that theory is encoded by a network like this. Will wait is the is what you're trying to predict. And it turns out that that's a class, and class variable causes all the feature variables. If that is the case, now put on your Bayes network hat on. Is that a Bayes network? Yes. What numbers do you need to specify this Bayes network? You need a prior for this, probability he will wait. And for each one of here, you need a thing saying, if he does wait, what's the probability that patterns equal to full given he waits, and patterns equal to empty given he waits. Those are the numbers you need here. Agreed? I'm just asking you to remember your Bayes networks. I mean, if I have a network like A causes B, C, D, then I need P of A here, and then I need P of B given A, P of B given not A, and P of C given A, P of C given not A, P of D given A, P of D given not A. That's it. Those are the only numbers I need. If somebody gives me those numbers, and if I was ready right to begin with that this is the correct Bayes network configuration, then I have the entire Bayes network in front of me. And once I have the Bayes network in front of me, right, then somebody gives me a new example and says, in this new example, patterns is full, price is, you know, very high. What is the probability that is Russell going to wait or not wait? This is just a Bayes network inference problem. Given the evidence, what's the posterior distribution of will wait? Not the prior, but the posterior distribution of will wait. And if the will wait is more likely to be yes than to be no, then you just take the, they say he will wait. If not, you will say no, he won't wait. Okay? Agreed? So, in fact, what's more interesting, once I learn this network, I don't even need to give you my new example, doesn't even need to tell you every feature. I can just tell you, okay, the, you know, you learn this network, then I'll just say, well, the alternative, there is no alternative, and it's Friday. What do you think? And you'll say, yes or no. Yes, you will wait, or no, you won't wait. Then I'll give you some more information. Price is really cheap. Then you can change your mind. This is all Bayes network inference. Okay, so what I'm doing now is I'm going from this data to this network, and once I have this network, I can forget this data, and I can classify new data. That's what learning is all about. So what's my hypothesis here? Hypothesis is that naive Bayes net, that Bayes network. Now, doing classification this way is called naive Bayes classification, because you are in essence making a pretty strong assumption that of the many, many possible Bayes networks that can be drawn using all those variables and the class variable, the only one I'm interested in is, I mean, the only topology I'm interested in is this. So in fact, what does this topology tell us given what we know about Bayes networks? So for example, suppose I ask you, what's the probability that patterns equal to full and price equal to low given weight equal to yes? Suppose I wanted to compute this number. Using just your Bayes network hat, how would you write that? How would you compute that? Because they become multiplication. Will weight is the parent of both patterns and price. It's the only parent of patterns and price. Okay? So this is nothing but P of patterns given full times weight equal to yes times P of patterns, I mean P of whatever, the price equal to low given weight equal to yes. And these two numbers are present. This is not surprising. It's essentially what the Bayes network does anyway in its inference. There's nothing new. I'm just making it, you know, repeating something that you already know. Okay. So now the question, of course, is, given this data, how do I set the numbers probability will weight equal to yes? What would you do? This is what a reasonable thing to do. There are 12 examples, 6 are yes, rest are no. So in the examples, will weight equal to yes, the numerical frequency is 6 out of 12. So I'll put as 0.5. Okay? Right? Not a bad idea, and you know, it's like the first idea that comes to your mind, and that's what you'll do. And then how would I do probability of patterns equal to full given will weight equal to yes? Probability that patterns equal to full given will weight equal to yes. So consider only the rows where will weight is equal to F. Among those rows, count the number of rows where pattern is equal to full. People are waking up now because this is like the dumbest algorithm that anybody can write, right? So it's just number counting. You know, you count up these, so it turns out half the patterns equal to full. There are six places where patterns is equal to full. Two of them, six places where will weight equal to F. Two of them have patterns equal to full. So the conditional probability is 2/6, 0.333. So I have decided that the estimated numerical estimated conditional probability is the one that I'm going to put there. How hard is this? You know how to compute each of the numbers you need to compute. Now, when if I ask you, for example, what is the probability given a new example, what would I do? The Bayes network is written in the causal direction where the class is causing the feature. During performance, you'll only have information about the features and you are asked the information about the class variable. So basically, Bayes network inference would use Bayes rule as part of it. Okay, in this particular case, you could have just said, well, I will give this information to that Bayes network tool that I used in the project 3, and then anytime a new example comes, I'll throw that in and then tell me yes or no. And you'd be right. Okay? It so happens that you don't need their tool. You can actually, for this simple case, essentially what you're doing is just using Bayes rule. That's it, nothing else. Because you're doing diagnostic inference. Because the evidence is always going to be about feature, and the question is always going to be about the class. Because it's a classification problem. Okay? So given that, so my question would be something like, what is the probability that will weight equal to yes, given patterns equal to full? This is the kind of questions I'll have. Okay? That would be written as probability that patterns equal to full, given will weight equal to yes, times probability that will weight equal to yes, divided by probability that patterns equal to full. Now, this denominator can be normalized away. And the rest of the numbers are already computed. Okay? Naive-Bayes classification is the kind of classification that we would like to do because it doesn't require too much thinking. You know, is there much of a training going on here? No. You just look at the number of examples and take numerator by denominator. There is no training complexity. Is it too hard to actually plug these numbers to compute the class? No, that's not also hard. Naive-Bayes is really, really cheap version of Bayes network learning. It turns out that the basically same idea would also work if I give you some other Bayes network configuration. If I tell you the network configuration up front, then you can always compute the CPTs. So if it turns out that this sort of simple reasoning will always work if I have, even if I have something like A causes B and C, B causes D, and C causes E. This is a more interesting network. Or in fact, A causes B and C, and B and C both cause D, and only C causes E. I can learn the CPTs for this network too, as long as I have all the, each of my training examples tells me what is A, what is B, what is C, what is D, what is E. If you have complete examples, that means that each training example gives the value of each of the nodes in the Bayes network, then just taking numerator by denominator, just taking relative frequencies is going to be enough. Now, the question is enough with respect to what? Why was I right in taking 6/12.5 as the right number? I mean, is this somehow the optimal Bayes network? Assuming this is the topology, how do I know this is the optimal Bayes network? Other than the fact that I know how to do division, now what's the reason I'm looking for it? So the rest of the class I now do the reverse Seinfeld episode and essentially try to explain to you why we think it's reasonable to do this kind of numerator by denominator. That's the basics of statistical learning. Okay? And I'll end before showing this back again. And then you just have to replay it in your... And how many of you have seen the reverse Seinfeld episode? And I just wanted it to restart after the whole thing was over because, you know, my mind was replaying it, but it had gotten over. So you have to replay it at home. Okay, this is the final technique. But we will try to explain to you why this makes sense. There was a raised hand somewhere. Okay, yes. No, the point is this. The only thing that you need to know is the Bayes network configuration. If you know the Bayes network configuration, then you can compute the CPTs. What you could ask is, what makes you think that this is the correct Bayes network configuration? What makes you think that I have no other work to do than to give you a Bayes network configuration? And if you ask that question, you're asking a very right question. When I give you the Bayes network configuration, I'm giving you domain knowledge. Or at least I'm giving you my bias to you. Naive Bayes classifier is saying the world is made up of naive Bayes networks. Perceptron is saying the world is made up of lines separating positives from negatives. It's a very strong bias. Bias is a kind of domain knowledge. Okay. Now, if you say all I know is that Russell is using maybe a two-layer Bayes network. I mean, this is two-layer, so he's using a three-layer Bayes network. Then you can do the numbers and see how many three-layer Bayes networks are there. Each one of them is a competing hypothesis. And for each of them, you have to see what the numbers are and see among them which is the one that's going to best explain what Russell is doing. Okay, now, first, one other thing that I should point out to you is this. This is the same example that we've been looking at, right? And on this Russell example, decision tree is at the top curve, naive Bayes classification is in the bottom curve. Okay, what happens? If I do naive Bayes classification, that's where it will be. And notice that the number of examples, it's basically, its learning rate reaches about 0.8 and stays there. It never becomes 100%. Why? Because the true Bayes network underlying Russell example is not expressible as a naive Bayes network. So you are finding the best naive Bayes network, but not necessarily the best Bayes network. Okay? Just as if I tell you that all you can do is finding a line, right? If I tell you all you can do is finding a line, and my points are like this, then I'll just draw some reasonable line, and it'll never be 100% correct. But if I tell you, well, you can actually draw any arbitrary non-linear curve, then you'll say that's the curve that actually separates positives from negatives. Again, bias is important. Bias makes your life easy, but it also stops you from reaching 100% accuracy. Naive Bayes network is saying that the only configuration you have is class causes features, and features are all independent given the class variable. That's not actually true. Features may actually be having correlations. When one feature is true, the other feature is likely to be true, even beyond what the class variable's value is. And furthermore, some features might be derived features. Some two features depend upon a third feature. And so if you do have all those things, then the Bayes network winds up being multi-layer Bayes network. Now, the interesting thing for Bayes networks is if I give you the entire Bayes network configuration, the specific configuration, and I give my training examples in terms of all the variables, then finding the CPTs is very cheap. Unlike in multi-variable, multi-layer neural networks, where finding the layer weights is still hard, finding the CPTs is much cheaper. The hard part, of course, is there are many, many such multi-layer Bayes networks, and which one are you going to pick? Okay, and to do that, you have to do optimization. Questions? Other questions? Okay. So now I go back and try to argue, or at least try to make sense as much as possible today and the rest next class, as to what actually does it mean to learn in a statistical sense. What does learning mean from a Bayesian sense? And the most interesting point is there is no such thing as learning. If you ask Reverend Bayes, he says there is no difference between learning and inference. It's all inference. Okay? And that would be actually very nice. If in fact there is no such thing as learning separate from inference, then you have one less chapter to read. Okay? But it turns out that Bayes is actually right in an optimal sense. Bayesian learning, which doesn't differentiate between learning and inference, is the optimal any learner can do. But no computational program would ever want to do it because, as we'll see, in essence, Bayes does not pick a single hypothesis. If there are 10 hypotheses, he considers all of the hypotheses equally at the same time, saying, well, this is more likely, this is 0.8 likely, this is 0.1 likely, this is 0.001 likely, and keeps all of them in their hand and does a weighted summed classification. That's why for Bayes, there is no such thing as learning. Everything is determined by the data. And we'll see that from there, we will actually simplify and the problem by saying we'll just pick the best hypothesis. Okay? And having done that, we will show that finding the best hypothesis oftentimes essentially involves maximization over likelihood, which is essentially like taking derivative and equating it to zero. And when you do that, in fact, you'll find that taking the derivative and equating it to zero will tell you that the right thing to do to find probability for will weight is to take the number of examples total in the denominator and take the number of examples where will weight equal to yes in the numerator. So what we did without thinking, thankfully turns out to be the right thing in a mathematical sense. Okay? So you can still continue doing it, but if somebody asks you why are you doing it, there's a deeper theory how you're doing it. Okay. So here is Bayesian view of learning. So think of learning in Bayesian sense as just updating probabilities in the hypothesis space. Suppose you have a space of hypotheses, okay, H1 to HN. Okay? There is a prior on the hypothesis space, which tells you which hypotheses are more likely and which hypotheses are less likely. That's the prior, P of H. Okay? So think of it this way. This hypothesis space can be infinite. Okay? And this P of H essentially is a distribution over all possible hypotheses. Okay, so if you think that most likely hypothesis is that a normal distribution underlies it, then this prior H is essentially saying normal distributions are more likely than Poisson distributions. And Poisson distributions are more likely than delta distributions. Delta distributions are more likely than some other distributions. Okay? This is the hypothesis prior. Now, jth observation, and you're doing observations, and the observations essentially are telling you the data that is coming out. Okay? And so, you have training data D1, etc. up to DN. Now, given the data so far, each hypothesis now has a posterior probability. Okay? And that posterior probability, which is probability that HI is the hypothesis given the data you have seen till now, is using the Bayes rule, because we are doing Bayesian learning, probability that D is the data given HI is the hypothesis, okay, times prior probability of hypothesis itself, HI itself. This is just direct Bayesian updating. Okay? And this PD of HI is how likely is the data given my hypothesis? That's what it is asking. This is called likelihood. So suppose I believe that the underlying process is a line, how likely is this data? Not very likely. How likely is this data? More likely. And furthermore, suppose I believe that the underlying process is either this line H1 or this line H2, and my data that I'm seeing is like this. What is the likelihood of data given H1 versus what's the likelihood of the same data given H2? It's higher given H2, right? So you would think that H2 is actually causing the data than H1 causing the data, okay? So this is basically likelihood, and you notice that the distribution, prior posterior distribution, is essentially a function of likelihood and the prior distribution. Those are the two aspects. Now, given a new example, right, and you're trying to find out its class, then all you're going to do is what's the probability that x equal to true, what's the probability that the class of new example x is equal to true, given all the data that you have seen in the past and their labels and the hypothesis HI, times probability that HI is the actual hypothesis underlying the data. Okay? And this one, you would actually simplify this. You will assume that hypothesis HI completely characterizes the data D. So given HI, then D is no longer relevant. So this becomes P of X given HI times P of HI given D. Okay? So from a Bayesian point of view, when the new example comes, you can label the new example using just these numbers, which are directly computable. Okay? To show, so there is what's more interesting. Have I picked what is my best hypothesis? No. I'm keeping all my hypotheses along, and I will say this hypothesis is 0.9 likely. According to this hypothesis, you're going to be plus. And this is a 0.2 likely one. According to this hypothesis, you're going to be minus. So your weighted probability is still more plus than minus. Okay? Let me put this in colorful candy terms. And this is a very nice example, E2. So suppose I have 5 kinds of bags of candies. All candy bags look alike from outside. You don't know which bag is what type. It turns out that there are 5 types of bags. Okay? One type of bag has 100% cherry candies. Okay? Another type of bag has 75% cherry candies and 25% lime candies. I think there's something to do with cherry and lime candies in UK. Is anybody from UK? Apparently, you're not supposed to like lime candies. So Russell hates lime candies. So this is his example. So the second type of bag is 75% cherry candies and 25% lime candies. The third type of bag has 50%. The fourth type has 25% cherry, 75% lime. The fifth bag is 100% lime candies. And if you read the textbook, it says, yuck, he doesn't like Papa. So anyway, so the interesting question is, these are the 5 types of bags. And in this factory is making up millions and millions of these 5 types of bags. And they have looked at their clientele and found essentially probably that the kinds of things that seem to sell are 50% one. So they are making more. 40% of the factory bags are of the type 50%. Okay? 10% each are all cherry or all lime. 20% each has 75% cherry, 75% lime, or vice versa. Do you understand now what I'm saying? So in the factory, if there are 10,000 bags, 40% of those 10,000 bags are likely to be of this type. 10% are likely to be of this type, 10% are likely to be this type. So I went to the factory, randomly picked a bag, came to you. And I started removing candies and showing you one after other. Okay? You are trying to predict. And once I show you the candy, you know whether it's a lime or cherry. Okay? You're trying to predict. As I'm showing you the candies, your interest is predicting the flavor of the next candy I'm about to show you. Am I going to show you a next cherry or a next lime or next whatever before I show you? Okay, all you know is the data you have seen from the bag. I have picked the bag. I'm not changing my bag. I have my bag and I'm picking it out. So you know that this bag was picked up from the factory. So it's one of these five kinds of bags. Furthermore, so your hypothesis are hypothesis one, hypothesis two, hypothesis three, four, five. What is the prior on the hypothesis? The prior on the hypothesis is 0.1, 0.2, 0.4, 0.2, 0.1. Okay? So you have everything here now. Prior of the hypothesis also is available. So then we observe some candies drawn from some bag picked up from this factory. And here are the candies. Lime, 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 lime. The question is, of course, you're trying to predict what's going to be the next one. And you're going to predict it using the hypothesis. Okay? So the question is, you're doing two things. One is, which kind of bag is it, and what flavor would it be next? Remember, hypothesis-based learning always first tries to pick the hypothesis, and then pick the bag, no, the next color. What's interesting is that if you consider the probability, so remember that the prior probability of hypothesis is this. The blue one was 0.4, these two were 0.2, this is 0.1, and the other two are 0.1, remember? So this number for each color, I think there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 colors, and so there are two numbers here, one number here in the beginning. So if you did not see anything, given just the prior probability of hypothesis, I'm about to open a candy bag. You are assuming that most likely my candy bag is of the blue variety, so which is 50% cherry, 50% lime. And so based on that hypothesis, you assume that there's a 0.5 probability that it's lime and 0.5 probability that it's cherry. If the prior was different and such that, in fact, the prior was highly weighted towards cherry candies, okay, that means 100% cherry candies, bags are made 90% of the time, then even without me opening the bag, the first candy you'll say, ah, it's going to be cherry, and you'll be right, okay? So anyway, if you look at the posterior probability distribution of the hypothesis, as the examples come, posterior probability distribution of the hypothesis as the example comes, and this corresponds to this, posterior probability distribution of hypothesis given the data, as the data comes, you notice that as the number of samples come, before everything this is a prior, as you see more and more and more and more lines, it becomes inevitably clear to you, and also to Reverend Bayes, that the posterior probability that the hypothesis all lime bag is what you have is close to 100%. Okay? And then every other type of bag keeps going down to zero. But notice that even after you saw 10 bags, it's still possible that you may either be having a 100% lime bag, or there is still a reasonable probability, 20% probability, that you have a 75% lime, 25% cherry bag. Because it's actually probabilistically possible that, you know, for the first 10 of a 75% lime bag would be lime, 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 lime. Okay? But if you see a million of them, by that time, this thing will be driven all the way down to zero, and this guy will be the only guy left. What's more interesting is, if I stay somewhere in the middle, after seeing four, then what Bayes would do is, if I give the new example, he would try to classify the new example using all the hypotheses. Says this one says it's lime, but and it's about 0.5 likely, and this one says it's, you know, whatever, most likely one for red is also lime, and that's 0.3 likely, and so you take the weighted summation of what the label is going to be and pick the most likely label. And if you look at that, Bayesian prediction for this, as you see examples, the prediction accuracy of the next sample, in this case, you'll notice, you know, essentially goes to 1, obviously. By time 10, notice the interesting thing, by time 10, this hypothesis is still only below 0.8 likely. And yet, you are able to get 100% classification accuracy on the new incoming one, because weighted probability is telling you that this is going to be a cherry, this is going to be a lie. So according to Bayes, there is no difference between learning and inference. And furthermore, it turns out that Bayesian prediction is optimal in a strongly theoretical sense, that if you are given the hypothesis prior, and the true hypothesis is in the prior distribution, that means it has non-zero prior value in the prior distribution, it's not removed, then as you keep seeing data, ultimately the true hypothesis will reign supreme. You cannot keep it down, because it's impossible, basically, it's impossible for wrong hypothesis to generate, a hypothesis to generate an uncharacteristic data indefinitely. Okay, it's possible for a 20% cherry, 80% lime bag to generate cherries for the first two samples. Even though it's very unlikely, it's still not 0.00001, it's 0.2 times 0.2. But it's very unlikely for it to generate 1 million cherries in a row, because that would be 0.2 power 1 million, which is truly small number. Okay? So all we are saying is Bayesian hypothesis essentially will catch up, the true hypothesis will actually catch up. And when the data is not asymptotically large, keeping all the hypothesis on hand and doing weighted classification actually winds up giving you an edge. The only reason people don't do Bayesian hypothesis, Bayesian learning, is keeping track of all the hypotheses is easy enough in this problem because there are 4 hypotheses. If you have n Boolean variables, you know there are 2 power 2 power n hypotheses. So you start getting into major trouble if you want to keep all the hypotheses around. So if you don't want to keep the all hypothesis around, you do one of two things. Let me just mention those two and you get to go home. One of which is to say, remember what we were doing in the way we were giving the label for the new example is to take the weighted summation over all hypotheses, weighted summation over all hypotheses, and the label that hypothesis gives. If I don't want to keep all the hypotheses, I would say first pick the hypothesis that is maximally likely and just use that. First pick the hypothesis that's maximally likely in terms of the posterior distribution and just use that. So once I compute the posterior distribution, I just pick the one that is the maximum likely one and then just use that without the summation in the actual classification. If you do that, since you are multiplying these two numbers here, if you take the log over that, you are in essence picking maximum over the multiplication is the same as maximum over a logarithm, because both are the same, monotonic. So in essence, you are picking the maximum over this expression, log of likelihood plus log of prior. And picking the best hypothesis like that is called MAP, or maximum a posteriori hypothesis. You can do it even more simple and say, look, I assume that all hypotheses are equally likely, in which case this term can be ignored. Then I will just take the hypothesis that makes this number the maximum. That would be the maximum likelihood hypothesis. And you wind up mostly doing maximum likelihood hypothesis to make life simple. And what naive Bayes network was doing was computing the maximum likelihood hypothesis. Next class, in the beginning of the class, I'll show you that for the cherry example, in fact, you could have computed the parameters for the maximum likelihood hypothesis by just taking numerator by denominator, even if you were to do, derivatives and equate them to zero. So that would have completed the cycle. Thanks.